Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's the Tuesday edition here on Zero Block 30. I have a fun little antidote before we get started. So this morning I woke up my kid, and it's the first of the month. I was like, hey, it's February today. They're like, oh, cool. So it's April Fool's Day.
What?
Close.
Like, it's February 1st. You're like, oh, so it's April Fool's Day. I was like, no, that would be April 1st.
Almost.
And Cardi was like, oh, that makes more sense. Yeah, it does. And it makes sense that we have five rounds in the magazine today. Round number one, starting the show with a little bit of a safety brief. We're going to tell you, don't drink antifreeze. I know it smells delicious. Still, just don't do it. It really does smell like it might taste good.
Yes,
and it looks cool.
Yes, it looks like it's delicious.
Baja
like
Blast.
If you had two scoops of Breyers vanilla and you dumped a little antifreeze on top,
yeah,
you got yourself a sundae.
That's hitting
the
spot.
I'd give it a sip.
Yeah, you got yourself a sundae. Round number two, nothing gets my blood pumping like a tale about gold and then their hills. The FBI might be doing something shady with $400 million worth of Civil War era gold. We're going to tell you about a story which should be a movie, no doubt about it. Round number three, huge shout out to the Chief of Staff of the Army. I love stories like this one. You're going to hear a soundbite. It's incredible, and it's actually not going to be from Major Payne. Round number four, the Air Force has some new spray-on bandages that will help you heal like your Wolverine, whatever that means. And finally, round number five, I sat down with the only person in the Afghanistan-Iraq wars to be given the title of sole survivor. Bo Wise joined the show to talk about his book, Three Wise Men. And all that is going to be brought to you by our friends at 3Chi. If you've been listening, if you've been following me on Twitter, you know I'm a big 3Chi guy. It's the industry leader in Delta-8 THC products. All products are formulated by a biochemist and made in the USA with USA-grown hemp. 3Chi's Delta-8 is federally legal version of THC and is a more functional alternative to marijuana. It gives you an amazing buzz and a great body feeling, but with a clear head and less anxiety and a bunch of giggles. If you're like me and watching TikTok videos late at night, you're going to start cracking up like I do. It's available at 3chi.com. That's the number 3chi.com at retailers around the country. You must be 21 to purchase. And remember, this is not CBD. It's a psychoactive. It will give you a buzz, so make sure that you do it responsibly. If you're on active duty, I would say don't do it because you are most likely still going to pop on a piss test. We don't want anybody doing that. Go to 3chi.com, enter the promo code ZBT2021, and you're going to receive $5 off. They have gummies, vape tinctures, and oils, all kinds of stuff. You can make edibles. You can do whatever you want to. Go to 3chi.com, enter the promo code ZBT2021 to receive 5% off at the checkout. Let's get started with the show.
I got my Patagucci on. I got my Barstool beanie on. I'm ready to go. I love a good snow.
Did some chocolate chip pancakes for breakfast this morning. Oh, wow. It's coming down sideways out there. We're supposed to get up to 20 inches here in New York City. So and in Rutherford, New Jersey. So looking forward to it. I went for a walk in the snow late last night, and it's just a... We haven't really had a good one so far this year, so it's nice to just get out there. And
we had that one that was maybe like 6 or 8 inches, which is not bad, but you're right. Like a really big one like this, it's the best when it really first starts last night, like you're talking about, before the plows can get to it and it's all serene and still very clean and perfect. That's the best time.
Yeah.
Barstool Carl posted a picture of somebody like where you have parking spot wars whenever you're trying to clean out a spot and then you get it back. That's something that I don't ever think about, being a Texas guy and a Florida guy. Like, when I see people shoveling, and I'm like, you have to do this pretty consistently? That's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Every few hours, at least, out there killing it off. Or, like me, you let your car get completely encased in snow so that the people who ticket it can't reach your windshield wiper.
Yeah.
Well, that's the trick. I think I've mentioned this before. You got to go out. If you're going to get really crushed, you got to go out a few times throughout the evening to get it going so you don't really break your back when it's built up big time.
When I was a company gunning on Quantico, I had to stay in the barracks whenever we would have a big snowstorm just to make sure that all the Marines in the barracks were good. And I always, even though I never minded giving like junior Marines things to do, like just because that's what they're supposed to do, I always did feel bad when I would tell the duty, go wake up Marines and have them go shovel the battalion headquarters, where they'd have to go out there waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go do it. That just sucks, man.
Yeah.
It just
not
sucks.
A good time. But yeah, for people in like Fort Drum and some of the bases that are constantly snowy, that's probably the bane of their existence. Like, that's probably what their number one working party is like snow duty shit, which sucks.
Yeah, but I think
better than me
up there. I have to imagine at least some of them have a little, they're a little more equipped to deal with this stuff with snow blowers and maybe some plows attached to gators or whatever, just because it would be ridiculous.
If you have Lance Corporals and you're using a snow blower, you're a shitty leader.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right, Kate.
That's
exactly
like, well, I think I've said it before. My dad, for the longest time, he refused to get a snowblower. He's like, what am I going to get one of those for? I have you. And then I went away to college and then he got one.
Mm-hmm.
That would be purchase number one for me if I lived up there. I would definitely buy one.
It's worth its weight in gold
it.
For sure. Absolutely.
I would be putting it on credit, whatever I had to do. Let's get going with the show. Actually, round number one. This one... You know, this one is a tricky case because when I first saw it, I was like, oh, man, I want to make fun of this. But people did end up in critical condition. So it's like you got to kind of tread lightly. But also, it was a chief warrant officer, some NCOs that were involved. You should know better. I mean, I don't think you should even say like, oh, it was nothing but junior troops. They shouldn't know better. If you're a grown person, you should know not to just start drinking stuff that you find lying around in a shop. Right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't care what it looks like or how delicious it looks like or how much money somebody says they'll give you to take a sip of that thing.
I've made a lot of terrible decisions regarding alcohol in my life, but this has not been one of them. Like, even I knew better, so they should. That's for damn sure.
So the story actually comes to us from Military Times. Kate, what does it say?
So an investigation, and we got tagged in this so many times. People saw this, everybody's like, ZBT, ZBT. people doing stupid shit with alcohol. An investigation into what sickened 11 soldiers who ingested an unauthorized substance. You can only ingest authorized substances, people. Shows they drank an industrial compound found in antifreeze, believing it was alcohol following a 10-day field op at Fort Bliss.
They don't really get into how this came about.
Yeah.
Like, right. What are you doing where this could be a thing? I mean, I would understand it more if you were in a deployed area and people are like, this smells a little bit like booze. Let's give it a little sip. We haven't had any in a while. But when you're just doing a field op, like you're going to drink stuff that you find in a shop there.
And I've never been like, oh, I have this extra antifreeze. Let me pour it in this Belvedere bottle for safekeeping. You know, like you don't really transfer that out of exactly what it is. Can I just say, I guess it's 1st Armored Division. I would say this has something to do with Motor T.
I
feel like those little rapscallions would be the ones.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Colonel Allie Payne, Public Affairs for 1st Armored Division at Fort Bliss, said that lab reports indicate soldiers consumed ethylene glycol, commonly found in automotive products, including engine coolant and brake fluid.
Okay. Now, real quickly. So I just Googled ethylene glycol. Yeah. And there shows a little violet. It's clear. Now, it is ridiculous, but it is possible that these people thought like, oh, yeah, this is just a Motor T. This is how they hide their vodka. They put it in some vials or whatever that make it look like it's a fluid that we use to fix our vehicles when, in fact, it's actually alcohol. I'm going really far outside the box. I'm not excusing this, but
I
can
see. Are you putting your little Motor T hat on? No offense to Motor T. I'm going to get so many DMs. The 11 soldiers, including two who were in serious condition, were being treated at William Beaumont Army Medical Center on the border of El Paso, where they have been since Thursday afternoon. Two soldiers needed critical care, but their thankfully conditions were upgraded. One of the soldiers had to be intubated, but no longer needs breathing assistance. Up to 4 soldiers expected to be released from the hospital soon. Again, unclear why the soldiers thought that they were drinking alcohol. It's prohibited for Army personnel who are on duty, including while in a training environment, and it's unclear what kind of disciplinary action they are going to face. once they are all back on their feet again. Again, it's a clear, this ethylene glycol, clear, colorless. Is it viscous liquid at room temperature? So it just looks like regular, probably just looks like water or vodka, like you said. When used in antifreeze, it has fluorescent coloring, like yellow, green. Can look like
it's
a
beautiful.
Baja.
Ooh,
it's
yeah.
beautiful. It looks like a Baja Blast. I'm guessing, again, I'm putting my little, no offense, my little Motor T hat on. I'm guessing there was a fluorescent part to this, which is
maybe
what
they thought it was like Jägermeister.
Yeah, here's the problem though: the fact that it happened to 11 soldiers, not one or two who were just kind of the guinea pigs who had the $100 put up, so they decided to try it out. There were 11. That concerns me.
And one of them was a warrant officer. Two of them were NCOs, and 8 were enlisted. I gotta imagine the chief warrant officer here is going to get his pee-pee big time slapped. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. to be. The senior ranking person, an officer, to do this kind of stuff. Oh, man. I bet you go in front of your major or lieutenant colonel or colonel, whoever it is, and having to explain this, there is no explanation. No. Like, what do you say?
The only thing.
We were
again,
bored, sir.
What if somebody was like, hey, we're back from this field op. I've mixed us all this fun drink, which, again, this is fraternization all around, also. But what if they pre-mixed and was like, hey, everyone, try this punch that I made or something like that. Like, what if others didn't realize? The other thought that I have is that ingesting this stuff, yes, it can lead to nausea or organ failure or headaches, but you could also, it says euphoria. So maybe the first person who tried it around the office was like, oh my God, this is the shit. Everybody, you got to try this. And then it wasn't as great.
It
as-
turned into that's a little possible. Huff and gas situation.
Yeah,
right.
That's possible. So, that's very possible.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys though. I would never just take something from someone and drink it. If someone handed me something and said, here, drink this, I'd be very suspicious and I would be very hesitant to
just drink
it.
Are you sure you were in the military?
Yes.
Because I feel like this is 50% of smoke pit goofing right here. Yeah. Is somebody handing you, like, I bet you won't eat this like little thing of C4. And you're like, well, yeah, I will. I'm not a pussy. And you're eating, next thing you know, you're eating a little bit of C4.
Let me ask you guys a question about this. Because if we have certain people in the world, I feel like you know if you're an intelligent person or above average intelligence. And I also feel like you know if you're average intelligence. I don't feel like you know when you're stupid.
Right.
Like
it's a gift.
It escapes you a lot. Like you don't realize that you're dumb. You just think you're like a normal. But if you knew for a fact that you were average at best, below average, I got to feel like if I knew if I was in that boat, I would just start huffing gas. Like, that would just be my thing. But I would just embrace it and just be a gas huffer.
But for what? For what reason? What do you hope to gain from huffing gas?
I mean, what do I have really to gain? I just think it'd be a good time. Like,
yeah,
it's
what
just
do you
such
have to
a
lose?
Cheap vice to have.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see me getting into that, too. And
you
like
see
we...
chaps wandering around to gas stations. Oh, who's that? Oh, that's the guy who huffs the gas.
I mean, if you get hooked on heroin or coke or something like that, that's expensive. Gas, yeah. I mean, right now, that's $1.98 a gallon. Like, you can just go get that and just get nuts for a while.
It smells great. I still
hang
love
out
it.
At the street corner for a little bit and get you a little pint. That's all you need is a pint.
If they still made markers like they used to, man.
Gasoline markers? Absolutely. What was your favorite one? The kindergarten markers that came in like the styrofoam where you could slide it back in? What was your favorite one?
Whatever the smell was really knocked my socks off as a kid. Yeah, so whatever that
oh,
was.
Oh, well, they had all kinds of different ones. They're all the different flavors for the different colors. I was always a huge purple guy. Great.
Wait, are we the dumb ones, chaps? Have we been sniffing and huffing and
are we the baddies?
Are we the baddies? I don't know. But we did an episode a few months ago where we asked people, like, what's the grossest thing you ever saw somebody eat on a dare in the military? We got like 1,000 answers from like, I mean, so I was
like lizards and
this isn't that crazy. It's kind of predictable.
Yeah, but this doesn't make any – I think if this is something like, oh, they drank a little antifreeze, if people didn't end up in critical condition, we're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the critical condition part that makes it bad.
Yes.
I'm going to say it looked like a Baja Blast, and everybody just went for it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to round number 2. Okay, you found this story, and it is super interesting. I think that there's – it's amazing throughout U.S. history how you feel like you know like a decent bit about a history. And then things like this pops up. This should be a bigger story. Like the fact that there might be $400 million of gold just floating around should be a bigger story.
And as a Pennsylvanian, I'm mad I hadn't been out looking for it now.
Because you gotta look for it. I actually, just yesterday, got in the mail my first ever metal detector.
This could have been ZBT's thing. This could have been our cash cow, and we really blew it. But yeah, this is a pretty crazy story. A Harrisburg attorney said Thursday that the state appeals court has just given a clue toward hopefully solving a mystery of whether the FBI dug up a cache of Civil War gold worth about $400 million from a remote Pennsylvania forest nearly 3 years ago. This is an intriguing case where Finders Keepers LLC, a treasure
hunting company,
they pointed the feds to a site the excavators hit. Federal authorities are refusing to tell Finders Keepers or anyone else what, if anything, they found. First of all, huge mistake by Finders Keepers to alert the feds when their excavator hits something fancy. I wonder if they're like required by law, depending on where they're digging. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always wondered about that. Like, if you find something like buried treasure or treasure ship, is that yours?
Why would you have to pay taxes on it?
I don't know. If gold was indeed at the bottom of that hole, then the clients should be entitled to a cut. But a cut of what? Ooh. As highlighted in a 1983 issue of Lost Treasure magazine, there's your next magazine, chaps, that you got to start getting besides your homesteader. Mm-hmm. The legend holds that a Union lieutenant by the name of Castleton was given orders in spring of 1863 to head on over to Wheeling, West Virginia, to Harrisburg. So from Wheeling to Harrisburg with two wagons that had false bottoms holding gold bars.
I love a false bottom on
you. Love a false bottom. That would be worth $400 million today. Lieutenant Castleton was ordered to travel northeast to avoid encountering that pesky old General Robert E. Lee and his Confederate Army, which was massing in Pennsylvania for what would become Gettysburg that July. When he believed the situation to be safe, Lieutenant Castleton was to turn the wagon train south toward Union headquarters in Harrisburg, and then the load would be shipped to Philly, to the Philadelphia Mint, from there. With eight cavalrymen and a civilian guide by the name of Connors... Captain Connors, none of whom knew of the gold, Lieutenant Castleton's expedition headed out. Soon there was an omen of troubles ahead. Lieutenant Castleton took ill with a debilitating fever, and Mr. Connors assumed command, if I had to guess, probably drinking antifreeze.
This sounds legitimately like the Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
Like, they got dysentery. He was bit by a rattlesnake.
They shot too many squirrels and their meat spoiled. It is believed the expedition stopped in Butler, Pennsylvania, and then Clarion, where I got very drunk after a rugby tournament once, where a still-ill Lieutenant Castleton reassumed his command. He determined they were far enough north to avoid contact with the rebels, so he charted a course that would take the wagon train to Ridgeway in Elk County, then eastward to the Sinamahongong River in Driftwood, Cameron County.
Nailed it.
Where they'd construct a raft and float down the Susquehanna River, then on to Harrisburg.
I mean, this is like the Oregon Trail meets Huckleberry Finn.
This is ridiculous. The expedition made Ridgeway... It sounds like it could have been very simple, and then these guys made it real difficult. The expedition... Classic, man. The expedition made Ridgeway without problems, and after resting, headed off for St. Mary's, 11 miles east. During the trip, Castleton got ill again, and while delirious... told everyone about the gold wagons.
Oh, man.
Loose lips sink wagons. Yep. Mr. Connors reassumed command. The expedition loose wagon your lips sinks wagons.
Yep. Okay.
Anyway, the expedition made it to St. Mary's, and after a night of rest, set off to cross the mountains toward Driftwood, 20 miles farther. Lieutenant Castleton and the eight soldiers would never be seen again. With $400 million worth of gold, they just disappeared into the boonies of Pennsylvania.
And so this story goes on. That's like the main tale. But they've been trying to figure this out for a bit. In 2008, there was an article in the Pitt Gazette that kind of broke it down. Really, it was the first time there was huge news about it in a while. And they said that there was no documentation, description, letter, official report, no paper trail of any of the money at all. But they said the professor said that everybody wants a piece of the Civil Wars, and legend tends to be formulated around wishful thinking. You don't want to be a citizen of an era where nothing ever happened, which I don't think happened in the Civil War. I think you knew something was going on there. Mm. And they went on to say, what happened to the gold is a mystery. People in the country are not without shovels looking for it. Nobody's ever going to find it, which makes you want to go find it even more. If you're finders keepers, and somebody says they're never going to find it, and there could be 400 million, and you don't even have to rent like a submarine to go find it, I think you could look for it. I might take my new metal detector up there and go look for it right now.
That might be the chap's summer vacation. You taking your kids, hey, kids, grab a shovel. We're going looking for gold.
Well, it's interesting. Give me the gold. Professors and stuff were all saying like, no, this is probably just like a made up thing, whatever. But then there's actual records now from like that this actual treasure hunting place told the feds that, hey, our ground penetrating survey that the FBI commissioned it. Why would they commission a ground penetrating survey and then be like, thank you, treasure hunter people, we got it from here. And then they did a dig
with 50 agents and they had all kinds of armored cars that showed up.
Right. Yeah. So
you don't roll out that kind of red carpet for something that isn't potentially better, more likely than not there.
So a lot of brainiacs saying wishful thinking, but then a lot of actual evidence pointing to maybe this was the real deal. So how do we find out then? Who do we call at the FBI to be like, hey.
Well, this one judge magistrate in Pennsylvania is trying to do that because of the Freedom of Information Act. He is petitioning that they release this information to see what happened. But I don't know how you could prove it. Like, if you don't have any documentation, they could just be like, no, that never happened. It never happened at all.
There's no way the gold would still be there if, like, as many as 8 or 9 men knew about it. Why would they leave it there? You know, like, what would be there?
And not for nothing, but even today, if you think about it, let's say you go and you only find 20 gold bricks right now. If you go try to exchange that and get it, whatever the current value of gold is for 20 gold bricks, that's going to set off a red flag somewhere. Like, everyone's not walking around with gold bricks. Like, some people have some gold, but not a lot of people probably have 20 gold bricks. So
if it was Lance Corporals, they probably just walked right into like a hussy saloon with him and was like, here you go. Like, we're going to have the best night ever. Not realizing it was worth way more than
Listen, yeah. I can't wait till McConaughey makes this movie. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I always think it'd be a good one for Quentin Tarantino to do in like a Hateful Eight type of style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Oh, man.
It would be great. All right. Let's move on to round number 3, which is going to be brought to you by our friends at Simply Safe. Everybody wants to keep their home and family safe, whether it's from a break-in, fire, flooding, medical emergency, 2 feet of snow, whatever you got going on. The home security delivers a 24-hour a day, 7-day-a-week protection. With Simply Safe, you don't just get an arsenal of cameras and sensors. You get the best professional monitors in the biz. They got your back day and night, ready to send police, fire, EMTs, or whoever you need straight to your door. Simply Safe has an arsenal of sensors and cameras that protect you. You can set it up in just about 30 minutes. It's super easy. Go to the Simply Safe professionals take over monitoring your home all the time. Right now, our listeners get free home security camera when you purchase a Simply Safe system at simplysafe.com/CBT. You also get a 60-day risk-free trial, so there's nothing to lose. Visit simplysafe.com/CBT for your free security camera. That's simplysafe.com/CBT. So this one is just a real quick round. I was very impressed with the chief of staff. If I was a general, just not even like a chief of staff general, I wouldn't even have to be the 4-star in charge of an entire branch. If I had the ability to promote people on the spot and do meritorious promotions on the spot, it would be something that I did pretty consistently. Like, I would make it a thing where I did it once a month on my base. If I was in charge of a base, I would do it once a month. I would send out a letter and be like, look, everybody, I want you to know there could be a time and once a month, I'll see people out doing station beautification, doing things that you think nobody's watching. If I see you, I'm going to be carrying rank in my pocket, and there's a chance that I promote you on a spot. I love that kind of stuff.
I love that, but it also then does become a situation where everyone just sees you walking around post and then starts acting really well. Cause like,
starts S in your D all the time. Yeah.
He hands out. That doesn't happen for generals anyways.
Well, right. Yeah. Not to mention generals aren't usually just like wandering about on base. They're usually getting shuffled to and fro.
But they usually have an office that they can oversee stuff.
General Chaps is in a ghillie suit in the smoke pit waiting for someone to say something kind.
Or I'll demote you too if I see you walking around with an umbrella.
Absolutely.
That would be nerve-wracking to be on your post and just worry that, I don't know, Chaps might promote me, but he might demote me. You're just
you got to keep people on their toes.
I do remember hearing stories of, like, you know, every now and then, you know, a general saw so-and-so picking up trash when they didn't, like, when they were totally by themselves and they got promoted. So I would always really obviously pick up any trash I saw and be like, holding the cup, throwing
it almost
it
happened to me in Okinawa. The Commandant of the Marine Corps came through one night when we were on post, and there was elevated security on the bases. They said nobody comes through the gates without being checked, without their ID. Nobody, no passengers, nothing. And so when the commandant was coming through in his detail, he was getting driven through, and I was a dog handler doing bomb checks at the base, like at the gate, and we were check IDs too. And so when he rolled down the window, it was a sergeant that was driving him. I checked his sergeant, and I was like, I need to check your passengers too. The commandant rolled down his window in the back seat, and I was like, I need to see your ID, sir. And he was like, do you know who I am? I was like, yes, sir. You're the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And he was like, you want to check my ID? I was like, I was given instruction to check everybody's ID. And he was like, do you have corporal chevrons on you right now? And I was like, no, sir. He's like, damn shame. I was going to promote you on the spot. Start carrying them. And I was like, fuck.
Man.
I've heard that story before, but I thought you were going to tell the story about the time you almost got promoted for swimming under Okinawa in record time.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anytime you can swim under Okinawa. So here's the chief of staff, what happened. And not only does he takes it to another level. Like, whenever he promotes somebody on the spot, he takes it to another level. Here it is in his own words. You want to take that off?
Okay, let's get Mom on the phone. I talked to her mother real quick. Tell her a great job. Mom. Can I talk to her?
Yeah,
hang on.
Can you speak?
Yeah,
he wants to talk to you.
Oh. Hey, hello. My name is General Jim McConville.
Hi.
Hi, and I'm Chief of Staff of the Army.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I just met your daughter here, and you gotta be real proud of her. I just promoted her to specialist.
Oh, yeah, so nice.
Yeah, because all her fellow soldiers said she was a really good soldier.
That's awesome. I'm proud of her.
Well, I am too. And I just want to thank you for raising a wonderful daughter and supporting her while she serves the country.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so we'll send you some pictures, you know, so you kind of know who we are. And again, thank you so much for sending us a great young soldier.
All right.
All right, let's say we got bye to Mom. Okay.
One, I think this is funny in a couple ways because he's the chief of staff. And when you are the chief of staff or you're the commandant, you're the head of any branch, I think it gets into your head that everybody knows who you are. Mm-hmm. Like, because everywhere that you've gone for the last few years, at least the last 6 or 7 years, you've been at least a 3-star or 4-star. Everybody knows who you are whenever you're on base, when you're in uniform. So calling a specialist mother and them not having any fucking clue who you are is so perfect.
The other interesting thing about General McConville, so if you think about it, to reach the rank of even Brigadier General, 1-star, you've been in the Army forever, you've moved around, you've lived all over the world. Mm-hmm. Typically, people like that, even if you come from somewhere that has a very distinct accent, you just lose it over the course of time because you haven't been in that area for so long. But McConville still has a very thick Massachusetts accent from Quincy, Mass. So he has a very distinct tone. So it's kind of surprising that the mother didn't recognize him.
Yeah, my parents would have had to.
You think he's going to recognize him just based on the fact that he talks like he's from Boston?
No, I'm just joking. I'm just joking.
I love that story. I think it's one of those feel-good, and we've needed some feel-good stories. If you're a general and you listen to the show, start promoting people.
Yeah.
That's how you want to build some morale. Mm-hmm. Throw out promotions a little bit quicker. People will be happy.
Hey, what do you think? I feel like we haven't done this since World War II. We need to bring back battlefield commissions and battlefield promotions. Because how cool is that? Oh, how'd you get promoted? I got promoted on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm
badass.
I'm in for those. Yeah.
That is good. All right, let's move on to round number 4. it involves the Air Force, and they are doing some sciencey shit. I love this kind of stuff when the branches get involved in actually changing the way not only the military operates, but whenever they have a great invention, it's something that affects the civilian population too, like glow sticks, for example.
Mm-hmm. Absolute.
I'm a big glow stick guy. I love those. This one comes to us from Task and Purpose. They say that ever watched Wolverine's body spit out bloody bullets and think, gee, I want to be like that. The Air Force understands. And while it might not be able to give you Hugh Jackman's beautiful body, it's going to do its damnedest to make you heal like it. That's why the Air Force is funding a new research to develop spray-on technology that can reprogram the function of human cells to self-heal wounds 5 times faster than usual.
So like Neosporin spray on steroids.
Yeah, it's like that. I always think when I hear something like that, the soccer players that get the magic spray sprayed on their buttholes whenever they're in games and they're like, oh, now I'm better.
What? What?
What?
What?
What? What?
Soccer players. You never seen them have that? Like international soccer players, they'll act like they have like a hamstring cramp. Somebody will run out on the field. They have this spray can and they'll spray it on their legs and then they act like they're better. You never seen that? The magic spray in soccer?
You said something about buttholes in there.
They spray it on and around their buttholes. In order for it to work, you have to get at least 5 of the 8 spokes.
That's not true.
So this technology is still in development, right? So they're still working on it. Yeah. But it looks...
They're still working on it. The technology is still in development. It could be groundbreaking for treating war wounds and other types of situations like burns, skin grafts, or organ transplant. The impact of this research can be far-reaching. The convergence of biosciences with mathematical models can truly provide an inflection point to the advancement of the developing of the wound-healing sciences. I think it's pretty good. Like, I don't know if it'll ever work. Because you have Nu Skin. Did you guys ever try Nu Skin before?
No. Sure.
Yes.
Connor, explain what Nu Skin is.
Isn't it just the tape? Or is that what you're thinking of? The tape that you put over blisters?
It looks like nail polish that you paint over a cut.
Yeah, no. It's like the goo you put on the blister. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so it'll cover it up. We used to have to do it in tennis. If we had some pretty intense tennis practices, you bust out the Nu Skin a little bit.
You played tennis?
Huh?
You played tennis?
Yeah, dude. I actually was a semifinalist in the Florida 5A tennis team.
Oh.
I was semifinalist.
How is it that I've known you for nearly 5 years and I am just learning this now?
Because that's a bit, again, chaps, not saying this kindly, that's a big game of pivoting and your ankles are.
Well, that's why I had thin ankles. That's the reason why I was fly to foot. I had quick feet.
Ooh.
That's my big takeaway from this round.
All right, Agassi.
Wow.
So they have this new spray, but it got me thinking, this is going to be something, if you give it in the hands of troops and you could put it in like your gear, this is going to be something that's big time abused. I could see, because you know, like those videos, Terminal Lance will post it, Max Uriarte will post it a lot, where they do the knife in between your fingers. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep,
where you
game.
Do that
yep.
game.
Yeah, it's a stupid game.
That game becomes
a
lot less risky if you can just spray this on yourself and you're going to be healed 5 times faster.
Right, but it cannot regrow fingers, so let's keep that in mind too.
They don't know that. Do you think a PFC knows that? They don't know that.
Yeah, no.
All right.
No senior airman knows that.
No. Okay. Yeah, not at all.
So I actually, I have a couple that I've done, like, I guess home remedies to get better. One was when I was in high school, and my mom was pissed about this one, by the way. So I was riding on the friend of my friend's Lauren's car in the parking lot of the high school. I hopped down. She ran over my foot when I was wearing flip-flops, and it tore off my big toenail and a bunch of the skin, like a very clean cut. So I took some super glue and like put it all together. Called my mom, and my mom absolutely freaked out that I did something like that. But it worked. And it never got, like, rotten or anything. It actually worked, and it was fine.
What is it about high school-age kids that we all feel the need to ride on our friends' cars?
You feel invincible. You think you're invincible.
Yeah, I really do, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
And then I also do the banana-induced pink eye healing, where if I get like a blister in my eye, I'll pop that with a razor blade and
please,
it's fine.
Please start videoing that anytime you do it, because every time you do it, you say you do it, and I ask, do you have video? You inevitably say no, and then I'm upset.
Well, it's hard because I have to use both of my hands. I have to use one hand to hold up my eyelid and the other one to do it. And okay. It's hard to get the phone in an angle where you can actually see it.
I feel like McCartney would be all about videoing that for Dad.
That's true. They might want to do that. Then the last one that I used to do all the time, when I wore boots, I would constantly get ingrown toenails, and I had a dedicated knife that I would use to cut them out, like a steak knife that I would use to cut them out.
I'd use a steak knife, and then I'd use it to butter my roll and proceed to eat my dinner.
Did you guys have any real, like, home
remedies? No, I didn't have a toe knife.
No,
sorry.
I didn't have a poop spatula or a toe knife or any of that stuff coming up.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, in the summer, if I like fell off my bike, scraped my knee or scraped my elbow or something, we would always just get sent into the ocean because we were told, like, oh, the salt water will fix it.
I will say, if they could finally come up with a spray like this that would cover your blisters and completely protect and encase them during hikes and stuff, why haven't we done that yet? Make the spray do that.
Yeah, but almost like, are you saying preventative to where you can spray your foot and it kind of acts like as a force field around your foot and ankles?
That, and then even if you got one, then you can spray it where it's like it creates like some sort of like hard barrier that protects you. I don't know. Yeah. It's about
that. Inevitably, the first time in the summer or the spring when you wear loafers with no socks, you're inevitably going to get a blister if the shoe isn't broken in
this
enough.
Benefits
so I feel
officers more than anyone else. Then we don't need it.
I put on my boat shoes and I got a blister, mother.
The officer's trench foot. Trench foot is loaf foot.
So I actually put out a tweet that said, what's something that you should have went to the doctor for, but you didn't? And we got some great responses. And this is always usually, if it happened when you were a kid, Dad was usually involved. This is a big time dad move to make you do dumb shit. Allie said, my daddy was always said that WD-40 and duct tape could cure anything. He was a Marine, so I actually believed him. I think that's true. I think we rely on dumb shit like that a lot. Brian said that he wrecked his dirt bike and cut his leg open pretty nicely. His granddad wrapped it up with duct tape and told him to go back outside. Scar looks the same. Who was I to argue? He was a corpsman in World War II.
Yeah, you're screwed if that's the case.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, you can't tell him that you're a bitch. I mean, that you, like, you have to do it. Removing stitches is one that I used to love to do. If I would get stitches, I was not going to the doctor to get that. Mm-hmm. I enjoy taking those out.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said that they thought they had a spider bite on their calf and decided to lance it with a knife on a field op. Next thing you know, they ended up in an ER after they passed out because it was MRSA, which then went into their bloodstream.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Yo, you can lose a limb doing that. Jeez.
Sure can. Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep. There's so many of people that cut themselves open and their dad told them just to use super glue, which I think happens because, you know, as a parent, you don't want to spend time in the ER because you have to sit there by your kid. It's going to take forever. So if there's something that and little kids are resilient, like their bodies are resilient, all that stuff. As long as they're not showing signs of infection, they're going
super
to be
glue.
Fine. Mm-hmm.
I mean, anytime growing up playing sports, I would hurt my ankles a lot. And there were definitely times that were worse than others to where you think you hurt something snap. But inevitably, I would just get home. We wouldn't go to the hospital for an x-ray or anything. I would just get home. I would sit in this one chair in our living room. My dad would go out to the garage, get a paint bucket, come in, fill that bitch with ice and water. And then I remember the first time I had to do this, I was...
I want for the record to know that Khan just said bitch.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I was 10 or 11 the first time I can remember really doing it. And I put my foot in and it was... Obviously, it was really, really cold, like piercing cold. So it's like, no, I don't want to do that. My dad just comes over, puts his hand on my knee, and my dad had these big old meat hook hands, and he just puts it in, and then I'm like screaming to let it out, and he's just holding it down in there. Yeah. Then eventually it goes numb and it doesn't hurt anymore, but that was a painful experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, good for Big Al making you not a little bitch.
Yeah.
our friend Maverick 2280 said, I had a nut. He's talking testicle, folks. Mm. I had a nut that blew up the size of a baseball. Tried to ice it and take it easy for 3 months. It kept getting bigger. Turns out I had testicular cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
Fellas, get your balls.
And I think this is the line that I draw. Like, I understand if you're toe goofing, if you have something going on with your elbow, if you have a little cyst on your shoulder, you're going to pop that. Once the old testicles start swelling up, that's when it's time to head on to the actual doctor. You don't want to see a nurse practitioner. You want to see an MD.
If something's weird with your genitals, you have like 2 days to get into somewhere. Why would you mess with that, of all things?
Yeah. Actually, I take it back. You probably want to see a nurse practitioner because they listen. Like, MDs just sit there and type their little dumbass reports, and a nurse practitioner will listen.
That reminded me of a story. One time I had a teammate. He had a cyst on his testicle. So instead of going and having that taken care of after practice, he's in the locker room. He undid a wire hanger and just like poked it with the hanger and then squeezed it. His face looked like it was going to pop how hard he was squeezing. And eventually like the cyst just kind of like popped out like a little onion. But that was a little rough to see him poking at that thing with a wire hanger.
What is wrong with people? What are people doing?
I love it. That's the kind of videos I want to watch.
Yeah.
They need to have a YouTube like channel where it's only self medical care.
Yes.
Watch the shit out of that. I watched one. Have you guys ever heard of tonsil stones?
No.
You have?
I had them.
You
for
did?
A long time.
What
yeah.
are they?
They
So tonsil stones, if you go on TikTok, if you're a TikTok user, go on TikTok. It is fascinating. So people will open up their mouths and they have like the phone in their mouth where they're showing. They usually take like a Q-tip, or some people even take their fingers. And at the back of your like throat, almost by your dangly ball thing, they'll push like on the side, and it'll be legitimately like a little stone. Like it looks like a little broke off tooth that forms back there, and it can get infected, and you push it out. It's called a tonsil stone.
What?
I had never heard of it until this weekend.
Yeah, it fucks you up. It's the only time I fell out of a formation, I was super sick, and I had a bunch of tonsil stones, and I had like 103, 104 degree fever from it because it was so fucked up. And then I go to the BAS, the Battalion Aid Station, and the doc's like, "Oh yeah, you got stuff on your throat," and they wanted to like pry at it. And then the chief comes in, he's like, "Oh no, you have tonsil stones. You need your tonsils out." I'm like, "Well, fucking thanks a lot, dicks."
God, Kyle, so, I didn't know you were so soft and weak. Wow,
yeah,
I thought Kyle was tough.
Well, once my tonsils got taken out, I was super tough, like the toughest.
Yeah, I bet. Last one I'll read. This one just makes me laugh because Eagle Scouts. First of all, how do you guys feel about Eagle Scouts?
I'll just say this: volunteer firefighter. That's all I'll say.
I knew you were gonna say that. Yeah, that's how I kind of feel about them too. But I do wish that. Those are good skills to have.
Yes.
Like to be an Eagle Scout, very good skills to have.
So that's the thing. That's the trade-off. It's like those are really great skills to have, especially if you go on to a career in the military and you're doing some stuff where you're out in the wilderness. But at the same time, when you consider how old you have to be to get to that level and what people your age are doing as opposed to being an Eagle Scout, that's the trade-off I'm not willing to make.
But you're an Eagle Scout. I think it's kind of like being the cool person at church.
Yes.
Like you're like the popular kid at church. You're the popular kid at the Boy Scout groups. But when you leave that, all that's gone.
Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. But still, I have some good friends who are Eagle Scouts. It looks good on college applications. I'll say that.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Shout out to the Eagle Scouts. Mm-hmm. But he says, my buddy was at a party in high school. He cut himself with a knife pretty badly. He needed a bunch of stitches. Our friend who was an Eagle Scout stitched him up with a thread and needle and then cauterized it with a red hot spoon that he heated on the stove.
That's awesome. So that's cool. Like to know how to do that and to fix someone like that. That resource.
They don't teach that in Eagle Scout.
But you don't need to carterize it. If he stitched it up, it's fine and good. That's all you needed. There was no reason.
I like
a red hot spoon.
No. I like that he went above and beyond.
So he gave him an infection, most likely. And this is one that I've done. Had a wart on my finger in college, sterilized it with a pocket knife, froze my finger, and got that thing good. It never came back. I've done the same exact thing. Mm.
By the way, I've been watching tonsil stones removal at home on YouTube for the last 90 seconds or so. Those are gnarly.
Yeah,
oh
pretty
God.
Intense stuff. Let's move on to round number 5. Where I bring in Bo Wise to talk about his new book, Three Wise Men, that it talks about his brothers and their sacrifices and how he's kind of embraced that and how he's dealing with that and how his family is dealing that. Here's Bo Wise.
Get on, Larry. No!
Now in Zero Block 30, I'm privileged to have Bo Weiss. Bo has written a book called Three Wise Men. And I think that that's a little play on words from the old wise men from the Bible. But it's his talking about his brother. Bo, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, chaps. Thanks for having me, man.
So you have a very interesting story. When I was going through some of the articles that were written about you through Washington Post and a lot of other places, one of the most common questions that you get asked is, does your story line up with Saving Private Ryan? And your answer has been no. Why is that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's some similarities, but one of the things that the reason I try to stray from that comparison is because, you know, the three of us enlisted pretty enthusiastically and very deliberately. Ben wanted to go before 9/11, and, you know, in Iraq, Afghanistan, the war on terror was not a draft war. Mm-hmm. And so focusing on them, not just enlisting voluntarily, but re-enlisting myself and Jeremy and Ben multiple times. I've tried to steer people away from that comparison, but I've come to the point it's inevitable.
And how, when your oldest brother was tragically killed by a suicide bomber, how old were you at the time?
I turned 24, the week after I graduated boot camp, and I was in Afghanistan, just about 6-7 months later, not very long, 7-8 months, somewhere around there. And so I was 24 when I deployed, and he was killed by a suicide bomber at Bob Chapman Coast Province, December 30, 2009, as was depicted in Joby Warwick's book, Triple Agent, as well as the movie Zero Dark 30, by the way.
Wow. And so how did that notification process go for you? I think most of our listeners are pretty familiar with the process of notifying Gold Star families when they're stateside. But when somebody is not stateside, how did that notification go down for you?
So I was in Helmand Province. I got to speak with Jeremy the week of Christmas, 2009. And then this was just prior to the invasion of Marjan, and we were kind of getting saddled up for my battalion was charged with the picket line for the Marjan invasion on the east side. We were in Nawa district right next door. And my platoon had linked up with a company north, and we had this big plan, elaborate plan for, you know, how to go, kick butt and take names. I'm not really sure if I.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Okay, cool. So we were getting ready to go kick ass and take names. And then the next morning, we found out the op was canceled in civilian terms. And, mm-hmm. The platoon commander just said, Lieutenant Barnes, he was like, hey, we're going south to Geronimo. Battalion's got something for us. We're all kind of confused. So we get to Geronimo, and he, you know, walks past the entire convoy and asked me to step out of the turret. And I followed him, and we went to the battalion COC in the middle of the FOB, the forward operating base. And he just walked me directly to this unmarked door, and it swung open, and it was the battalion chaplain. And I knew it was instantly that it was bad news. And the only one that I knew for sure was Jeremy. And, you know, so they informed me, and very, very quickly I got on an Osprey or 53 or CH-53, whatever it was, started the long journey home.
And what was your, because I know that there is a lot of mixed emotions when that type of thing happens, and not just whenever you lose a family member, but when you lose a close friend or anything like that. Or for my instance, when I was injured myself, there is this sort of duty that you feel. And I know that you probably felt it as a Marine as well. Was there a balance of you like, I got to go home to be with my family, but fuck, I don't want to leave the guys too?
You're absolutely right. And I thought about him every day when I was stateside, and I was in Virginia Beach, and it made it difficult, you know, to mourn or to grieve. And you're right. My head was a mess. And I had my brother Ben, thankfully, and, you know, my cousins, Nathan and Jonathan, who were pretty much like brothers growing up in South Arkansas together, like one town over. And Nathan was a Marine as well, twice deployed, so I mean, he got it. And so just having them, like, look, you're...
Jesus, you have, like, the most military family in the history of the world. Like, everybody did it. God damn, they're going to have buildings and shit named after y'all.
It skipped one generation. You know, my dad was a doctor, and Jeremy dropped out of med school to go to
Putz. Yeah, I saw that. I bet he's like, ugh.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, and he's, where did you get this from? And, you know, my mom said the same thing, and I was like, Mom, this is your family. I was like, this is your roots that...
Yeah, one of the articles that I read mentioned that your mom was like, why would you drop out of med school? And your brother said something to the effect of, well, because you read me biographies about Patton when I was a kid.
Yeah. Right. She still is quite the history buff. I mean, she's an encyclopedia.
So when you come home for something like that, a normal deployment, usually you do these medical assessments. They do like mental health screenings and things like that. You're leaving in the middle of a deployment, coming back home to a tragic event, knowing that your brothers in arms are still over there while you're trying to be with your brother in stateside. What was it like for you trying to balance mental health for yourself? And did you experience a lot of struggle in that time of, what do I do now? Because I assume you had to go back, or you eventually went back to your unit.
Yeah, I about 2 weeks later, I went back. And while I was home, it came in spurts initially, but I got to a point of numbness, you know. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, anybody who's grieved might be able to relate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like you said, it was so complicated in my head, you know, the fear of something happening to one of my guys, you know, thousands of miles away at the opposite end of the other hemisphere, and, you know, being home and feeling guilty, you know, and, you know, they're went from, you know, living out in the elements to, you know, back in a hotel while my guys are embracing the suck, and it, you know, it sucks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The best feeling in the world. And I really didn't even like grieve until I got back to Afghanistan, because I don't know, it just, that uneasiness was gone. And once I got back, I found that they did get in like a massive 4-day knockdown drag out, but everyone was fine. And so like they broke the news like, hey, we kind of got into a major engagement without you. And I was like, man, fuck you guys.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my first thing was like, is everybody all right? And they were like, yeah, you know, we're fine, you know, but, you know, don't worry. You know, we kicked some ass for you and we avenged Jeremy.
And I think that people just don't realize, like, your staff sergeants, your gunnies, your young platoon commanders, your company commanders, they are dealing with a bunch of Marines who had just been in a 4-day firefight, really intense situation. You also have you as a young Marine, a relatively young Marine that's coming back after losing your brother and trying to get back into the combat swing of things. It's a lot to ask for small unit leaders in that position, right?
Oh, it's, I mean, and the Marine Corps especially, I mean, they focus on leadership at a very, very early age, you know, and, you know, that's the first test of embracing responsibility. And like, you know, and the Marine Corps squad leader is, you know, corporal sergeant level. And so, I mean, it starts, you know, pretty early. And like, I believe my team leader at the time is actually younger than me, I think. That was kind of like the old.
Yeah, it's funny, right? 24 is like the old guy. Like, if you're 24 and you're just joining, like, what the fuck are you doing, old man? Like, are you going to be able to hang out with us? So before you go back, I imagine, did you have any difficulty when, after coming to your brother's funeral, was there ever a time where you're like, I'm not sure if I want to go back, or were you itching to get back to country?
No, I was itching. Ben and I were both hurting. And, you know, even though we're trying not to admit it, we were just trying to brace ourselves. And, you know, in again, it's, I mean, it was a double-edged sword, because you feel guilty and, you know, you want to, it, not being able emotionally to take part in the grieving process. That was a hell of a struggle back and forth. But it was like, I don't know, when I got back to my little patrol base, Casa Bonita, all of our positions were named after South Park names. But I got back to Casa Bonita and it was just like all was right with the world again, or at least for a short period of time. And I was actually able to grieve there, you know, like a post was actually something that I actually started to look forward to, so I could have a little time to myself and just grieve my brother.
Was it hard knowing when you were headed back to Afghanistan, knowing that your mother just buried your brother, like looking at her, I imagine going back in that moment was an incredibly difficult time for your family. Have you guys really had the chance since everything happened to kind of unpack those emotions about how she felt?
Yeah. And, you know, that was something I think if Ben were here, he might agree that we both tried to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And we was, you know, you when you want to just get back with your guys, you think about, you know, all the emotional trauma endured by family members, loved ones, wives, widows, and, you know, sister, father, mother, all of that. And it sounds callous, but when you're downrange, I think that I at least was actually trying to dislocate from it. You know, it's hard to do that kind of work with a heavy heart. Yeah. You know, just do what you can to make it home, you know.
And you, it's a terrible word to say, but it's almost like combat in that situation is almost convenient. Like where you have to focus on something, you can't be thinking about anything else. It's a very tunnel vision. I dealt with it whenever I was going through a divorce while I was overseas. My grandfather had died. And I look back now, even though I'm not comparing that situation with what you went through, yours is horrific. But for me, looking back now, I constantly still will Monday morning quarterback decisions that I made. Like, should I have stayed longer? Should I have tried to approach my chain of command and be like, can I go back and deal with these things? Did you struggle with that for a while of Monday morning quarterbacking every decision that you made afterwards?
Yeah. You know, and it kind of compounded later. And one of the things is, I mean, you know, with brothers, there's a rivalry. I mean, Jeremy, larger than life, 10 years older than myself. Ben, you know, 7 years older than myself, and they were born in like
7. And none of y'all are pussies, fucking Navy SEALs, right. Green Beret, Marine. Like, you guys have got to, you're okay.
Right. And I, you know, but I was a grunt, and like, I kind of had like a long-term goal, and I see you're a Marine as well. Semper Fi, brother.
Semper.
But my end status, I had finally, you know, after kind of like bouncing around like different options, I had finally settled on, you know what, I think it was my second deployment. And I was like, I want to be a battalion gunner. I like the idea of being a warrant officer of infantrymen. I liked, you know, the knowledge that they had and just like being the tactical advisory, but not having to make, you know, as far as troop movements and stuff, just advising along the way and kind of being that coach and the keeper of secrets of, Marine warfare. I thought that was really awesome once I finally had exposure to it. And our battalion gunner was forced recon, sniper, like been to every facet of the infantry. I was like, that's awesome. And so like eventually I was going to go to SOI, I was going to go to recon, I was or BRC and try out for recon and do all this crazy stuff. And then when the sole survivor status hit, there was that, like, I was never ever going to live up to Jeremy and Ben in my mind. Like, even after, you know, they were gone, I was just like, I felt like a lesser Marine and a lesser brother in many ways.
Yeah, man. When I read that part, and we haven't talked about your other brother and what happened to him yet, but whenever you met with General Amos and he said to you that, or you overheard him say that he's not going back, like referring to you and how gutting that was. I don't think people who don't serve in the Marine Corps or who don't serve in active combat understands how gutting that is. Yeah. I told a story a couple of weeks ago of how I got to go to President Obama's inauguration ball. And it was the same type of thing. I asked Sergeant Major Kent, who was a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps at the time, if I could go back to combat. And he said, absolutely not. Like, you got shot once, you're not going back. We don't need you to go back. You're not doing it. You're going to stay here and train. And for me, essentially, that was the end of my Marine Corps career, because it would be like playing in the NFL or practicing every single week and never getting put on a uniform and never get to go out there and play on Sundays. That's how I felt.
Yeah, it was Rudy without the final release, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you had this conversation of what happened to your older brother, your oldest brother, whenever he got hit by a suicide bomber. Your other brother, Green Beret, can you explain what happened to him?
So we deployed again in 2011, and the length of each deployment, which would have hypothetically originally, I think, was about the same time span. I came home and then his battalion got extended, and he told me right before I ripped out of Helmand, and then we get back to K Bay. And I had married my beautiful wife, Amber, and we had just settled into our tiny little $2,000 but 500 square foot apartment in Kaneohe. That's how it is in Hawaii. But and
we're just still married.
What's that?
Still married?
Oh yeah.
Oh, congratulations! I mean, that's an accomplishment for Marines to make it through a couple deployments still being married. Well done.
10 years in a March, and we have two beautiful kids, a boy and a girl. And yeah, thank you, man. And yeah, this call came in the middle of the night, and my mom, it was my mother, and she told me, look, I don't want to alarm you. Ben's been shot, but we think he's okay. We think it's in the legs. That's all we know. And information came in very incrementally and very slowly because Ben's guys were still in the fight. So there was no after action report. We didn't really know the severity of his wounds. It was just he got shot.
On a Green Beret, they're probably involved in a high value target type of mission, and right. You don't want to put any of that stuff out.
And he was working, it was part of a task unit, I think. I don't remember, but so yeah, like you said, they're still in the fight, and the information came back. Well, he was his task unit or task force was charged with taking over this this village, this series of compounds. And there was this cave network adjacent to this village overlooking it. And the guys on the ground were taking fire from the caves. So Ben and a few others were clearing out these cave networks. And he breached a cave. We would find out later that as he was breaching, he fragged the cave and started pieing around, the entry hole. And then unfortunately took 8 to 10 rounds to the chest, legs, and groin. And he fought despite taking 10 rounds almost point blank. He fought for 6 days and he was a badass man. He was a warrior. And he fought long enough to say goodbye to myself and his wife, Tracy. We flew out to Germany and got to be with him in his final moments. But January 15th, 2012, he passed away in Landstuhl, Germany.
And now that you're going back and you're seeing your family again in that same type of horrific, I don't know any other word to describe it, that situation, getting off and embracing your mom after coming back, was there something different about like all your relationships after losing both of your brothers and being like, okay, this is, I got to look after mom or I got to help out? I imagine your head was spinning.
Yeah, there was a lot of guilt initially because they left from they left from Arkansas and they were on a separate flight. So they were, however, the travel plan worked out. They were just about 24 hours, I think, behind us. Mm. Yeah, or maybe a little more. I don't remember exactly, mm-hmm. But they were literally, if looking back and putting the timeline together, they were probably touching down in Frankfurt when Ben took his final breaths. Mm. And so I had the unfortunate responsibility of telling them in a van on the Autobahn outside the airport, which was, one of the worst thing I've ever had to do. Yeah. And so there was a lot of guilt there. And I remember asking the surgeon, I said, look, is there anything that we can do to stall for time just so he has an opportunity to say goodbye to my parents and vice versa? He's look, man, I'm going to do more harm than good if we do that. So, and I don't know why looking back, but I felt very, very guilty about that. Mm-hmm. And when I told them, honestly, I think it was just emotionally, it was shut down for almost everyone. And I asked my mother, I said, please don't view the remains. I don't want that to be your last memory of him. Mm. And my father, on the other hand, was a reconstructive plastic surgeon. And I don't know, just to a doctor, I thought
cognitively it's a little bit different because he's seen things more often.
It would help him understand. And I'm built like him. So I know that I thought maybe he should. And I still have guilt about both of those as well, both of those decisions as well. And, you know, but one day at a time, we try and, you know, just deal with it and cope as best we can. There's no playbook for stuff like this.
And we've talked to a bunch of people like Kyle Carpenter and Florent Groberg and like basically any Medal of Honor recipient that we've ever spoken to. It's, you get put in this position where people want to hear your story and they want to commiserate with you and they want to feel as much empathy as they possibly can for your story and recognize the heroism that's involved with it. But at the same time, it's an awful feeling to have to explain some of the worst days of your life over and over again. When did you get to the place where you thought, you know, this is a story that people need to hear about sacrifice, not necessarily for yourself, but for the memories of your brothers?
Man, that's the, I mean, there, I'm still working on it. You know what I mean? This is a work in progress. There is no final destination as far as like getting to a perfect Zen place, you know what I mean? But the short answer, 5 years ago, I started journaling and I, you know, was on a downward spiral in the Marine Corps. I wasn't talking. I was just dealing with grief the wrong way. I did it in Afghanistan and I was doing it at home. And, you know,
did you have anybody in your leadership that recognized those signs and attempted to help you?
Oh yeah. And I hope he's okay with me saying his name, but they might have been promoted now, I don't know, but Sergeant Major Hatlin, used to be First Sergeant Hatlin, my first sergeant, and Major Hansen, outstanding, some of the most exemplary leadership I've ever experienced, and they were like, we need to get you some help. And I did not like admitting survivor's guilt. I didn't like talking, you know. I didn't want to hear the word survivor's guilt, you know? Kept denying it. I don't.
And it's kind of like PTSD too. Like when you're still in, you're like, get those fucking four letters away from me. I don't want to hear those letters.
Exactly. And I didn't like, you know, I didn't want to be diagnosed, you know what I mean? And they, you know, and the both of them, you know, reached out. And I think that there was probably some communication with family to them privately behind my back. And it was just genuinely everybody who was concerned, like, you know, my fellow sergeants that I was working with. I was an inspector instructor in Little Rock at the time. And there was a lot of guys like, man, come on, man, let's take some steps here. And so long story short, I found journaling and that just became a coping mechanism because it was at the time, this conversation that you and I are having right now was not possible. It was just little baby steps. And then it kind of prepared me, even though the journal entries, I think I gave like two or three to Tom Saleo, my co-author, who wrote Captain Groberg's book, by the way. He was the one that was like, said, yeah, let me see the entries. And it kind of gave us an idea and we synced up right away as far as what we wanted to say. And I had this outlet now. And journaling, I think, prepared me in a way. It was just that first step so that I could do what we're doing right now, you know.
And I want to encourage our listeners to go out and buy your book. It's called Three Wise Men by Bo Weiss. Bo, we won't take up any more of your time, and I don't want to give away too much of your story because I want people to buy your book. But I really appreciate you having the courage, one, to sit down and for your family, and not just your family, but for what you did. Because I think a lot of times in a position like yours, people can look to the ultimate sacrifice that your brothers did. But you've sacrificed a lot for your country as well. And I want to say personally thank you to you.
Caps, thank you so much. Thank you for your service, brother. And it was an honor talking to you, man.
I appreciate that. It's always good to talk to somebody that you could see when we're in the middle of talking. Bo had no idea who I was at all. Like, he didn't know what ZBT was. He just knew that he had to promote his book. He's not on social media. He doesn't listen to podcasts or anything like that. About one third through the interview, he looked behind and realized that I was a Marine. and his face completely changed. Like the way that he was speaking and the way that he wanted to talk about it, because he knew that there was some commiserating there. Yeah. Like, it's just so different. The brotherhood, sisterhood is just so strong.
What did he see in your office that made him realize that?
Probably Colonel Jessup.
I'm looking right now, and that's the only thing that's really a big identifier. You could just
see my cover, too, I think, in the back,
Okay, yeah. You could just be a really big Jack fan.
Yeah, huge.
I'm just always amazed at people, like, the smallest thing goes wrong in my life, and you guys hear about it for 10 hours. I'm like, oh, what was me? People who just have so much grace and poise and just – such an incredible perspective of looking at things. What an incredible person. And really,
I'm looking forward to reading the book. I've added it to my list of books to read, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's obviously such a unique story, mm-hmm. and he's obviously carried himself with such poise, as you said, Kate. So very much looking forward to that. Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating because the family is very successful. The dad's a doctor. The mom is like apparently a genius who knows essentially everything. The older brother, who became a Navy SEAL, was going to med school at the University of Arkansas and decided, you know what, I'm going to stop doing that, go be a Navy SEAL. Imagine how pissed your parents would be if you are in medical school already, your family's a physician, and you're like, nah, I'm going to go do something completely different.
And wildly dangerous.
But they seem like the kind of family, though, that was like – just that great of a family, like that they seem. Yeah. So
I mean, it takes a special kind of mom to raise three boys, and at night, instead of reading them Harry Potter or whatever, she's reading them biographies of Patton.
Yeah. Like, so,
but I mean, if you just, I mean, just from a statistical standpoint, the odds that you're going to have three sons, all three going to the military, two of whom go into the highest echelon special forces of their respective branches, and then, you know, the Marines in and of its own self is very respectable. So the odds that that is going to happen just speaks further to how great a set of parents they grew up with.
Yeah, Bo's a great dude. I really enjoyed speaking with him. Let's move on to save rounds and alibis. Kyle, we'll start with you.
I have kind of three. One, Cardinals, St. Louis Cardinals, making big moves in the offseason. Super excited about that. Just had to throw that out there. Feel real bad for Cubs fans. Just a tough break. Your whole team's falling apart. I mean, I my heart goes out to you stupid bastards. Second one is we keep getting a lot of DMs about just terrible morale throughout the whole military. A lot of suicides, like a real sad uptick in suicides. And it, you get them and you feel helpless because what can we do? I guess just, you know, take care of each other at that small unit level. You know, encourage your guys and girls, your troops to go get help and kind of keep an eye out for those warning signs. You know, if they're fucking up a lot, there's probably a reason. Mm-hmm. Don't go too hard. You know, keep the discipline up, but care about them because they're people. And that's just tough. We got one from a specific unit. They've had like five in the last couple months, and that's terrible. So, you know, short of just saying take care of each other, there's really not much we can do. And then third, did you guys see that the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, she did a good initiative, bad judgment move over the weekend.
What was it?
So there's an article posted from an airman about a single parent program she started. And it sounds like a great program. You know, single parent in the Marine Corps chaps or in the military chaps knows that shit isn't easy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so she started this program like a single parents retreat, get them, you know, out of their house, give their kids and themselves a break. Yeah. Good stuff. She wrote an article explaining it. But in the article, she kind of dragged her ex, who is also an airman. And turns out he's a PJ, and there's a lot more to the story than was in the article. Ooh. But the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, Chief Master Sergeant Bass, I always get it confused now, and I get so worried. But anyways, we all know who she is. She posted it, and then the guy's supervisor, the PJ supervisor, commented on the Facebook post. Is like, there's a lot more to this. You should probably look into it, because she's not all that great, and he went through a lot of shit. There was an affair and a DUI and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, there's a bit of a revolt going on in the Air Force community against the Chief Master Sergeant.
And once that information comes out fully and we have a full detail, we'll give like more of that information on Friday.
Yeah.
I want to make that unfold because I imagine she'll be issuing a statement if everybody's pissed. And it might be one of those situations where, you know, on The Office where Michael yells at Stanley and it gets everybody's attention. And then he does it to Phyllis at the end of the show. And everybody's like, okay, like you're a little too far. Where it was a good thing the first couple of times, but you can't keep going back to that. Well, Cons, what about you?
Over the weekend, I guess it was Sunday, that our friend of the program, he's appeared on ZBT more than any other guest. He's even hosted ZBT, but Representative Adam Kingsinger put out a video that I just felt like was really well done and worth watching about the future of the GOP. And, I just felt like regardless of which side you decide you want to follow or attach yourself to, it was just a very profound video with a lot of great points that it wasn't about attacking anybody. It was more about just unifying everybody as a country. And I just was really encouraged to see that from somebody that we've seen so much bad come from our politicians in recent years. To see that was really encouraging. So I would tell everyone, go to his Instagram page and watch it. It's about 6 minutes long and really well done.
Catherine?
Honestly, nothing for me. Truly. I'm sitting here in this low chair struggling to breathe. I'm having a tough time. So
yeah, I could tell whenever I had you read the first part that like getting your breath back, and I was like, I'll take over.
I hear it on the audio. I see in her track, it's just like you can see her taking deep breaths all through the whole thing.
This chair is
but
too
you're crushing
low.
It. 8 months in, you're crushing it, which brings me to the point that I want to talk about. Military.com had an article today about...
Well, I want to cover this more on Friday, but... So stay tuned for Friday's app. But are you talking about the women in the military getting shit on for having kids? Yeah.
Yes. So there's an article that came out. We're going to talk about it more on Friday. So I guess I won't talk about
it. Sorry. No, you can, but it's... Yeah, it's...
It's a teaser. Well, essentially what happens is that there's women who give birth in the military are really put at a disadvantage. They're asked to either hold on to their career and push off having kids, or it's seen like a slight, like they're not taking their career seriously, which is bullshit. This story profiles a gunnery sergeant that is in Okinawa, Japan. She had a baby, and the baby came out was very small. And her doctor told her that she needed to breastfeed for at least a year, and she was having trouble getting back inside the body composition standards after having a baby. But when you're breastfeeding for that long, you have to eat more calories. Like, you have to do all kinds of stuff. She was struggling to get back into standards, and they put her on BCP, which... is if you're a gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps, your career is over. That's if you go on BCP, your career is done. You won't get promoted ever again. And it's just terrible what they're doing. And we're going to cover it a lot more. But I want to reach out to see our listeners who have had a baby that are on active duty. Email me, chaps at Barstool Sports, or Kate at Barstool Sports, or Cons at Barstool Sports. Let us know if you've had anything like that happen, and we want to give some personal stories too. So hop into our DMs or hop into our email and let us know about that kind of thing, because it's very important. We'll talk about it on Friday. It's on the retreat.